Hold on, let's see if we get Sax on the line. All right, guys. I guess Sax isn't. I guess Sax is blowing it off because he's too busy.
Okay,
with his
Sax.
App.
No, fuck
so
Sax.
We'll start without.
Let's
start without Sax. Okay, 3, 2.
Let your winners ride.
Rain Man, David Sax.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the All In Podcast. With us today, the queen of quinoa on fire in California, which is also happens to be on fire, sadly, and the dictator, Chamath Palihapitiya. David Sax will not be joining us today. He's too busy with his All In app. Oh, I'm sorry. It's actually Call In. He put a C in front of it.
It's Callan. Callan.
Callan, his Callan app, which is debuted this week. But Sax will be, if you're a Sax stan, I think Sax is,
No, we've done one show without Freeberg. Now we're doing one without Sax.
Yeah, this will be the Sax free episode.
It is what it is.
Sax free episode. All right. So we got a lot.
I'm here.
Look who joined.
All too eager to take credit for Call In on Twitter. So don't pretend like you're not part
the
of it
app?
Now.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I meant Call In app. The All In app.
I hope Callan is worth $1 trillion.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. This guy is complaining that I'm leveraging the pod.
We should have done an Adam Newman style licensing of the term All In to Sax and gotten paid like $7 million in equity for him using our name.
Oh, my God.
I gave you guys so many shout outs, you know, during the
he did, because I listened to his interview with Emily Chang, and I listened to his thing with Axios with Dan Primack. And,
oh, did he?
He's very David had a very good.
He was magnanimous
presentation, and then he was really magnanimous and kind. So thanks, Saxy Poop.
And I gave so much credit to J-Cal. I said that if it wasn't for J-Cal, I never would have done this whole podcasting thing because it was too hard. I never would have figured it out.
And then you gave me a shout out because of organizing it so that we could all be friends on. I appreciate that.
Very nice. I actually haven't listened to it, but give us a, for those who don't know, David Sax has created a podcasting / casual audio app. It's called Call In. It's available for download for iOS, just coming out of private beta. My understanding is you're at somewhere around 10,000 folks.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of signups yesterday. I haven't got all the latest numbers yet, but. It's taking off. All the reviews of it have been sort of rave reviews. People are really excited about it.
Fantastic.
But yeah, look, the concept is we're combining social audio with podcasting. We call it social podcasting. You've seen these apps where people create a room and they have these many-to-many conversations. They tend to be ephemeral. No one really records or saves them. And the quality of the conversation is a little bit chaotic. But we've taken that concept and put it in the service of creators who can now essentially like record their pod in front of a live studio audience. They can bring up the, we call them callers. They can bring up people from the audience one by one to ask their questions. It's much more organized and structured. It's not a free for all to try and grab the mic. And then once you record the episode, you can then go into post-production in the app. You can edit the transcript in order to edit the episode, and then you publish it and you can share it. So
is it like, so it's basically like OnlyFans but audio?
It's OnlyFans but for people who
do
don't
still
look
jerk
good on
off
camera
at the end or no?
Family show.
Come on.
I do when this becomes a unicorn.
Blade is all getting cut.
No, not delete. It's my birthday today, god damn.
All right, happy birthday, Chamath. We're going around the horn here. Everybody's patting themselves on the back. Let's all take a moment to say what we like about Chamath. Okay. Great, let's get back to the episode. That was quick.
What do you, you know, I was thinking about, what birthday present do I get for Chamath? And then I was like, gee, what do you get for the dictator who has everything? I don't know.
What does Kim Jong-un need?
Exactly.
Wait a second. Just
what did they get MBS for his birthday?
Hey, we don't
have...
Very rare wine.
There's actually an answer to that question. Apparently, Madeleine Albright once got Kim Jong-un a basketball signed by Michael Jordan for his birthday. So apparently, apparently that's what you get a dictator.
Access. Yeah. You get them access to people they wouldn't normally have, or a bone saw.
Very old French Burgundy. Ideally could, white, but the white doesn't hold up as well. But, you know, if you go back, I mean, I wonder if you could drink like a... Yesterday, I had the two fills, Deutsch and Muth, at my house. And we had, we drank 1996 Salon Clos de Mesnil. No, sorry, 1997 Salon Clos de Mesnil. And then we drank a bottle of 1996 Paul Roger Sir Winston Churchill champagne. Fabulous. Only champagne last night. It was fabulous.
We could also get you some planonium. Planonium, if you want to.
No, guys, I don't
want to take out some enemies.
I would like you to come and play poker next Thursday, you fuckers. And then two is just bring a bottle of, bring a really nice bottle of wine or champagne. We'll drink it together. Right,
that's fine.
Oh my God, I got cases of terrible wine. I'm going to bring them.
No, you asshole. Did you hear what this fucker did? Piece of shit showed up last week and he's like, Chamath, here are these fantastic bottles. And I looked at this, it's like 1985 Camus. And I'm like, that's not a good year. I've never
right in the right in the garbage. Yeah. Right in the garbage.
Wait, it gets better. He has two bottles, and so he gives them to Joshua. And Joshua looks at them, and Joshua doesn't know what to think. And he looks at me, and so Joshua's like, "Wow, David, thanks, Friedberg. This is incredible. I appreciate it." And then Friedberg does the fucking most brutal thing: open it. Let's just drink it together.
And Josh was so appalled. He opened it and poured it on Chamath's cherry tea.
No one drank it. I threw it out.
He took it right to the herb garden.
No, yeah. He said, "Where did you find this?" He goes, "Oh, it was in my basement in the hot, temperate, humid fucking San Francisco weather for 10 years."
Yeah,
I had no idea. Like, oh. So I moved. You know, I moved like 2 weeks ago and I went to the basement to like get all my boxes and I'm like, I've got like hundreds of bottles of wine that I have not seen in years. And I start going
not temperature controlled.
Right next to the furnace.
They weren't lying flat. I'm like, these things are all like, they're all corked.
They're all corked.
And there's like stuff from the 80s, Josh, from the 90s. Yeah.
Sommelier Josh took them and poured them over the arugula salad.
He didn't want to ruin the arugula.
No, he didn't ruin the arugula. It would ruin the fucking vegetables and herbs in the garden.
He basically cleaned
them in the drain.
He poured them on Chamath's windshield.
Do not bring any more wine to my house.
Oh my God.
I'm bringing wine for your dog. If your dog's coming back with Nat, we've got
my dogs are coming back today. Yeah, they're flying back from
the All I have to say about that game is, thank God Mr. Beast has 100 million followers on YouTube. R.I.P. Mr. Beast. All right.
I give a shout out to Mr. Beast
is fucking incredible.
What
an incredible entrepreneur. What a great human being.
Yeah.
For 23 years old to be that sophisticated.
He's 23?
23.
This guy.
I thought he was 30.
This guy is clearly on track to being an enormous figure in culture. Oh, he's going to be a fucking multi billionaire.
He is determined, hardworking, smart, kind, good to
ambitious,
people,
clever,
ambitious,
amazing,
he's great, and his ideas. He's creative, and he's just a good human.
Mr. Beast was one of the most impressive people I've met in a really, really, really long
time. Totally agree.
I mean, he and I had been texting for a long time on Twitter, and then just on text. But then to finally meet him, and we had talked on the phone and we had Zoomed before. I'd never met him in prison, but what an incredible
We have him as a bestie guestie on the pod?
He totally fit in with the group too. Ugh. He was great, just funny.
You know what we should do is we should all round everybody up. We should fly to Greenville and we should surprise him. Yeah.
Yeah, do a little game at his warehouse.
here's an idea.
No, we could do is we could tweak Phil Hellmuth and just have a game and replace Phil in the game with him as our new bestie.
Done. Oh my God, that's great. Let's replace the Muth with Mr. Beast.
Kind of like a better bestie in many ways. Okay, listen.
By the way, are we skipping next week to record at the symposium on Monday, or are we going to do next week and then also do Monday?
No, let's double down.
Okay.
Double down.
Yeah, let's double down. All right, listen.
We have a lot of shit to cover.
Good notification. We're doing our first all together recording of the All In Pod a week from Monday. At the TPB symposium, no reason to...
The production board.
No reason to publicize it, but I'm excited because
it's a closed event. What is the purpose of the event?
I just get together a bunch of scientists, investors, entrepreneurs, and CEOs, and it's a day of science talks mostly, and then some business talks on the next day. But we're having a really fun event the night before with poker. Our friends are all coming to play poker, and we're going to record.
I'm coming for the science day. I'm there for the full science.
I'm staying for the science day too. I want to learn.
The poker night is going to have poker, and we're going to record the All In Pod live or together in person for the first time.
That should be really cool. And for those of you wondering, you know, we're going to do our own All In Summit, which will be probably like 100 or 200 iconoclastic people, and we're going to probably do that in the first quarter or second quarter of next year post-pandemic.
We got to choose a date. You know, my people are going crazy because you won't give them a date.
Well, I still think we should do it in...
Here we go. In
Rome.
Okay, so the dictator wants Italy, Rome. Sachs wants Miami.
I'm telling you guys, there Hotel Miami, Lucy may be the sickest hotel in the world. And I'll tell you why. The people, you have never seen these people ever. Okay.
These people are amazing.
Amazing.
Tremendous amazing. people in Rome.
They are. Okay. Great food. It attracts the hottest people. I mean, it's fucking
all right, we're
crazy.
Not doing it based on aesthetics. We're doing it on ideas, Chamath. It's not just aesthetics.
People aren't going to go to Rome, you know. Miami, the good thing about Miami is we know it'll be open no matter what, right? You know, we can't count.
Yeah, we can host our own super spreader event. Fantastic. No, I mean, we're host the Code Conference, Kara Swisher's conference, is at the end of the month, and Sky and Brooke and I are hosting our poker again. And I was like, is there any way this conference is going to occur? And if it does occur, what happens if they're, I mean, obviously everybody's going to be vaxxed, everybody's going to be masked. I don't know if they're going to do testing.
Wait. You think everyone should be masked at the conference?
They're going to be, unless it's outside.
Well, they're going to be, because it's indoors, and there's a breakout event amongst the vaccinated, which can happen.
Between Delta and Zeta, too, you're going to be forced to.
What do you think, Sax?
Well, I just think, how do you effectively have a meeting with people indoors when everyone's wearing a mask? I just think that's...
We're doing the TPB symposium.
Really?
Wait, you have to wear a mask?
Indoors, not during the dinner and stuff. Look, I mean, I think for poker, but we are testing everyone on entry all 3 days.
Okay, so, that makes sense to me, right? We do a rapid test at the door, and so, but then once you've done the test and someone's negative, why would you need a mask once you go in?
Well, I don't know about the test code every day.
The stupidest thing is they do stuff like make you wear the mask, but then take it off for dinner. What? You can't get COVID when your mouth is full? I mean, how does that work?
It makes no sense. That's the whole.
It makes no sense.
Put your mask on.
Well, let's
the hostess
do risk
stand,
assessment here,
and then take it off when you sit down 3 feet away.
It's security theater.
Well, let's do risk assessment. None of us would go to an indoor event if it wasn't fully vaxxed, correct? Would anybody attend an indoor event of this nature, hundreds of people, if they didn't have a vax requirement? I would.
Yes, I don't care.
You would.
What I would care about is. I wouldn't attend it if people weren't all being tested on entrance.
Okay, well, I'm trying to do vaxing first.
The vax doesn't seem to eliminate transmission.
So
right
for
now.
You to and go so, to an event, you would have to be vaxed and tested that day, morning of rapid test.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think in general, everyone's kind of standard. It's like make sure vax because it reduces the likelihood of transmission, but still, correct. Like it's not stopping transmission clearly. I'd rather, what I care more about is point of entry testing, which is what we're doing at our symposium. I just want everyone to get tested upon entry.
Chamath, what would you do?
Let's talk about something important.
Okay. Let's move on. All right, listen, stupid. I think the most interesting thing going on in our industry this week is Elizabeth Holmes' trial has begun. Jury selection started this week, and it's going to cover 12 counts of fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud over false claims she made about the blood test results from Theranos. They have now selected a jury of 12 Northern California residents consisting of 7 men and 5 women. It took 2 days to question around 100 potential jurors about their answers to a 28-page questionnaire that included news outlets they read, what news outlets they read, if they knew any witnesses, and if they had any negative medical experiences. And it was complicated to get these because it's impossible to not know about it. And now it seems the interesting thing is Elizabeth Holmes, who worked on this company for close to 2 decades and was involved in this fraud from start to finish, is now taking the position that she was under the control of her business partner, Sonny Balwani, and that he had been abusing her and controlling her. What are your thoughts on? And so he's being tried separately, by the way. They're going to be tried in sequential order. So whenever this trial ends, then he gets to get tried. What are your thoughts on if she will be convicted and her defense strategy?
I think this is more. This is like less about the specific evidence against her, as much as it's and it's much more right now about the. Whole Silicon Valley fake it before you make it approach to entrepreneurship. And, you know, we all hear this from you know, all the entrepreneurial kind of advisors and, you know, stories of experience and stories of success, that in order to kind of achieve success as an entrepreneur, you really have to oversell and promise and create an incredible narrative about where your business is headed. And in many cases, that gets ahead of you. Now, the public, the general public that doesn't operate within Silicon Valley with as much breadth as we do, I think they hear the stories of the Adam Neumanns and WeWork and the collapse and Elizabeth Holmes and this Trevor Milton guy and Nicola. But there's thousands of these other sorts of smaller stories where a VC rolls his eyes, where the first board meeting after raising money is like, wait a second, we're actually going to be half our forecast when we raise money. Or the numbers are going to be way below, or the product doesn't actually work as we presented it to you.
Sorry, I don't think I've ever funded a company where that hasn't been the case.
Exactly. And so I think that's the big question, right, Chamath, is like, does this trial kind of indict the way Silicon Valley operates and the storytelling models and the narrative models? There are examples of these people getting a little too far ahead of their skis, and maybe you can argue they could perceive something to be non-fraudulent while other people can, you know, kind of perceive it to be fraudulent. But don't we see this kind of broadly in Silicon Valley? And doesn't this kind of bring up a question on like, are all startups now, and is the industry going to have a shift as a result of this trial in terms of behavior as investors and as entrepreneurs, and how you tell stories, how you diligence, et cetera, et cetera?
This is only going to get meaningfully worse. I don't know if Elizabeth Holmes committed fraud or not. I think that, you know, these folks will be able to figure that out in detail. But here's something that I do know pretty precisely, which is the amount of money that's trying to get into Silicon Valley is going exponentially up.
Yeah.
And as that happens, you guys now see it every day where there are firms whose entire business now is just to literally write a check every day. They're closing deals every single day. They're doing zero diligence. And so what that's going to create is an incentive for founders, particularly those whose backs are against the wall, or who's doing something that's highly speculative and hard to diligence, to stretch the truth to get the capital. And it's impossible for guys like us to actually step in and do diligence on a lot of these companies, even if you actually have time. But then if the competitive dynamic is such that you don't even have the time because somebody else beside you is going to rip in a check by just meeting somebody, and, you know, quote unquote, having done the work on their own, which is impossible because they're not, you don't have access to somebody's, you know, financial books. This problem is only going to get worse. And so I think we as an industry just have to realize that there's going to be an incentive to lie. There's going to be an incentive to stretch the truth. And it's because of the amount of money that's available and
yes,
the lack 100%. Of diligence that's happening.
Sachs, is this an example in the case of Elizabeth Holmes of somebody being delusional as a strength or somebody committing fraud as a crime?
It's probably both. Now, look, I think you guys are giving a little bit too much credence to the media narrative that Theranos is a quote-unquote Silicon Valley failure. The truth of the matter is there was no major Silicon Valley VC firm, in fact, not even a minor one, that invested in Theranos, as far as I know. There was no VC on the board of Theranos. We've talked about this before. It was a bunch of kind of grand poobah types. And there was no one who actually had the technical competence to do diligence. And so Elizabeth Holmes isn't so much an example of Silicon Valley as somebody who was selling Silicon Valley. She was selling the promise of Silicon Valley. She was selling the idea that this was going to be a decacorn or a centicorn to people who are too unwitting to know. And I see, you know, Tim Draper, a lot people are really hanging their hat on the fact that Tim Draper wrote a seed investment to Elizabeth Holmes. That really is very different. You know, when you write a seed investment, apparently Elizabeth Holmes was like a neighbor of his. She clearly,
their daughters were friends, is my understanding.
Yeah, and she clearly was an impressive person. You know, she came across impressively in person. She obviously cast a pretty big reality distortion field to a lot of, you know, smart people. So, you know, she's the type of person who you would write potentially a seed check to just based on, you know, a talent bet. The fact that she later chose to engage in fraud, I don't think that's like Tim Draper's fault. And it doesn't make this like a Silicon Valley fraud. Again, you know, show us the VC firm that was hoodwinked by this.
But you are seeing, David, this trend of the firms coming in and not doing diligence, not having audit rights, not having information rights, not doing proper diligence, and basically relying on the previous investors.
Right.
How troubling is that? And what are you doing to protect Kraft's LPs?
Yeah. So look, I think there's a big difference between going into a board meeting and finding out the projections were inflated because, like, frankly, we all take projections with a grain of salt, right? But versus the founder lying about the past, right? So people are always going to put the rosiest picture, or they're going to puff up what the future is going to look like. And it's up to you as the investor to determine if that's true or not. But they cannot lie about the past. They cannot lie about what their revenue was last year, what contracts they signed before you invested. That is fraud, right? And that is what, that's where Elizabeth Holmes crossed the line. She wasn't just painting a rosy picture of, you know, what the technology would look like, you know, years from now. She was lying about their capabilities at the time people were investing. That is the line you cannot cross. Look, we conduct diligence. We, you know, try to look at financials. We try to make sure that the numbers are all true. You know, frankly, we're not investing in things that involve a tremendous amount of technical risk, a lot of technology risk. So we always use the product before we invest. The idea that the product would be faked, I think it would be hard to perpetrate that kind of fraud with a SaaS company. But so look, I mean, that's what we look at.
It's interesting you bring that up. I just dropped a link into the Zoom chat. Co-founder and former CEO of Palo Alto-based startup technology company Headspin, charged with securities fraud and wire fraud. And this guy, Lakhwani, 45 from Santa Clara County, basically was lying about their ARR in a SaaS company. And
this is my point.
A bunch of money. So this is an example of
it
somebody.
It can happen in every company.
Yeah, it can happen at any
company. SaaS, I don't think you're inoculated just because you invest in SaaS. My point is, if you have a person that's willing to rip in a check, $100 million, 3 hours after meeting you, asking for no diligence, at some point, David, your back is going to be against the wall because you're going to have to justify to your LPs why you aren't in some of these theoretically good deals, right? Mm. And some of them will become fraudulent. They'll just turn out to be. It's just the laws of distribution.
So it's a bit of a prisoner's dilemma, you're saying, Chamath.
I mean, well,
you have to get deals done. You're up against people who won't do diligence.
No, it actually comes down to something different, which is then you have to differentiate with real brand, meaning if somebody really wants you on the cap table, they will absolutely slow everything down to get you.
Correct.
Right? So for example, like let's assume like it's Mike Moritz. I'll use that. There is nobody in the world, I think, who's not a complete buffoon moron who wouldn't slow his process or her process down to get Mike to be on their board. Mm-hmm. And so if you're willing to basically just scuttle an entire process and just take the fastest money, I think it actually says something that there is more risk in backing somebody like you than somebody that wouldn't slow down. Right? So then, you know, the problem is there's fewer and fewer Mike Morrises in the world, you know? I think Sachs is one of those people. I think Peter Thiel is another kind of person. You know, Bill Gurley is another kind of person. So there are these people in our industry where I think that you will slow things down. And I do think allow these folks to do diligence. And I think there will be less fraud in general for that cohort. But if your platform becomes one that's just about ripping money in, and I think the late stages are roughly this, it's all brand independent because the money is the same, the valuations are the same.
Doesn't it introduce the risk of the retail investor? You know, we're seeing more retail participation via syndicates, via one-off investments, online kind of marketplaces, and also SPACs. Where the retail investor relies on, you know, Chamath, some of these kind of bigger institutional or perhaps some name that gets some carried interest in an investment doing the diligence. And if the activity level is going up and the dollars are flowing in and the margin of error is increasing, you know, is there not some inevitable kind of SEC backlash and consideration around how are private companies ultimately raising money? And how much they are disclosing, and we kind of face this, you know,
I can address this as a syndicate lead. You know, we only take accredited investor money at this time. And so anything that happens is with obviously sophisticated people, the top 4% of Americans investing in companies. And in our diligence now, we have seen a spike in what I'll call massaging or painting the picture in a way that I'm not comfortable with. And we have maybe tripled the amount of time we're putting into diligence now because I really care about my reputation. And maybe 20, 30% of the companies we wind up, after initially wanting to invest, maybe giving them an offer, getting an allocation, in recent history, 20, 30%, we're winding up backing out during the diligence process because their revenue was not software-based. There was $100,000 in consulting revenue. And for me, it's like, if you're going to, you know, make these kind of decisions early on in the company, I think it's indicative of future fraud or future moral or ethical issues. So we're sitting out in a lot of cases. There are public platforms now, Republic and Seed Invest, which I know are also increasing their diligence process because there's so many newcomers to the space. And I think there's a level, I'll be quite frank here, of entitlement amongst founders that is being, encouraged unintentionally by the lack of diligence that's going on. People are not taking the process as seriously as they did 10 years ago or even 5 years ago.
Well, Look, I agree. I think the diligence you're doing is really good. And here's where I agree with Chamath. So we have seen this trend in our industry of the private equity money coming in greater volumes, in greater, you know, earlier and earlier and faster, right? And it started with, you know, you have these, public company investors were looking at the value at IPO relative to the last private round. And they saw, wow, there's like 2-3x markup here for 1 year. Those are phenomenal returns. Let's arb that by getting into the last private round. Then they look at the second to last private round. They're like, well, wait, there's a big return there. So they keep moving earlier and earlier to arb out that return. But to Chamath's point, it's just they're applying a financial model where they're not in the diligence business. They're just, and I think they just see like fraud as a cost of doing business, right? Something they can model out with the portfolio. But the only reason they can model it out that way and have the fraud be an acceptable and predictable sort of cost of doing business is because you had these firms in our industry who actually did diligence at the seed, at the Series A, right?
Yes.
And now the private equity guys, they're moving so early. They're actually even now doing they're moving all the way to Series A. So no one's doing the diligence. And so, so that is a risk, I think, because it might actually change things. And this is where bringing it back to Elizabeth Holmes, I think it's important here that there's a conviction. I think she should do time. This was clearly a major fraud, big time fraud. And even if she didn't directly perpetrate it on Silicon Valley VCs, I think the message to the industry would be absolutely horrible if she gets away with it. And frankly, I'm a little concerned she's going to get away with it, because...
Well, she is incredibly charismatic. John Kerry was saying on a CNBC hit that don't underestimate her charisma and ability to snow people, and the Svengali defense, and she just had a baby, which, you know, people don't want to discuss because it seems like it's sexist, but she is a Svengali herself who will manipulate people
I like the way you say that, Svengali.
She's a Svengali, like a...
You mean Svengali, but...
Yeah, I'm talking in Brooklyn right now.
Sax, what do you handicap her likelihood of conviction at?
I think it's probably like a 50-50. And I think, here's the thing. When she was running this company, she wanted everyone to believe she was Steve Jobs. She even did the media tour with the turtleneck. She wanted everyone to know that she was a Jobsian micromanager who made every decision and was responsible for the success. Now that she's on trial, she wants us to believe that she wasn't calling the shots. She wasn't the person in charge.
She had 99% voting power in the company.
Yeah, look, this is sort of the Romy and Michelle's high school reunion defense where she wants us to suddenly believe that she was sort of like, you know, the sort of ingenue who didn't know anything. And, but she might get off because she kind of looks like Lisa Kudrow, you know?
Three references.
This is a lot of deep pulls here. You are going deep media. That is deep. The number of pulls there.
Based on the three ingenue, pulls, I know exactly how old you are.
Romy and Michelle's wedding, Lisa Kudrow.
She's going to go up there and pretend to be Lisa Kudrow or something,
like somebody offensive. Who's a ditz. It's super offensive that she wants to get up there and say that she was this abused woman. I mean, for women who actually are abused, for her to get up there and say she's an abused woman and she perpetrated this 20-year...
Hold on. We don't know whether she was abused or not. And if she was, it may or may not have implicated in what she did, which we don't know whether she did because, again, thank God for the laws in America, she is presumed innocent. Yeah. So let's all just like... I think what, David, where I agree with you is the following, which is... We do need to know that you know, investors, we all sign up for expressing the fiduciary responsibilities on behalf of our LPs or on behalf of our stakeholders, okay? There needs to be some equivalent standard that founders are held to. And there needs to be consequences for lying, particularly about the past. Because in the future, you say, I'm just projecting. But in the past, you're right. You have to be able to rely on what's given to you. Like, look, when we do diligence in a company, we are given everything that they have, right? We talk to their lawyers. We talk to their lawyers' lawyers in some cases. In the public markets, all of this has to be transparently published so that we can come to our own conclusion. Sometimes those conclusions are right. Sometimes they're wrong. But we can at least know that they're not lying to us. The minute that it turns out that they were fudging the numbers that they gave us, you're making, you know, the best decisions you can. You're assuming that it's great data, but if the data is fudged, you're fucked. And so to the extent that she did that, then she should be punished because we need that standard.
And this goes beyond money. She was switching people's results. She was saying that she was giving them a blood result on her incredible Theranos machine, and she was running it to the back and running it on an Abbott machine.
Is that right?
And she was taking investors, putting their blood into her machine, the Theranos machine, then taking them for coffee, running it to an Abbott machine and giving their results. I mean, this was the definition of a premeditated, deliberate, and multi-year fraud. Ooh. I put her at 80% likelihood of guilty, and I put the over-under at 32.5 months served. I don't know what
under. Take the under.
Taking the
I'll
under of 32.5 months?
I'll take the under.
What do you got,
Well, I hope you're right, because I'm a little worried that she's going to figure out a way to pull the rug over people's eyes here.
What are our kids going to get in jail if we were Chinese right now and they played video games? How many months are they going to get?
Basically, I think you would do harder time. So moving on to our next story.
No, the consequences is to the Chinese internet companies.
No, well, what's the consequence to the kids if they're caught on video games?
The companies
have to turn it off. Right.
All right, here we go. China bans young people from playing video games. This is for kids who are under the age of 18. They are now restricted from playing games on weekdays, can only play for 3 hours most weekends. And these were set as a response to China's physical and mental health being affected by gaming, according to Reuters. It limits...
I think they're doing what all American parents would want our government to do for our kids.
I don't disagree with that. Gamers are now penalized if they don't obey, and the gaming companies will be as well. Gaming companies will have to prove they have an identification system in place, like requiring monitors to use their real names.
Do you know how fucking hard it is? I have three kids in that age range. I am sweating who they're texting, who they're talking to, what game they're playing, the new game they want to download. Fuck that. This is the only thing I've ever said that would make me want to move to China. This one rule
is the
most incredible thing I've ever heard. And they're so smart. By the way, what's so beautiful is they send fentanyl on TikTok to us so that we get addicted to that shit.
Totally.
You know what I'm saying? And they're like, no, you guys are going to learn STEM so that you can, you know, take over the world. It's beautiful. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I would say like everything about China is a measured decision. Right. The Politburo, the decision makers are not sitting there randomly shooting from the hip based on intuition and saying, hey, I think we should stop video games. They seem bad for kids. There is clearly evidence and data and statistical models that are driving this decision. And their objective function is improve the health, the longevity, and the economic prosperity of our society as a whole.
I'm sorry, did you get this statement from China? What are you doing?
Continue, comrade.
I'm pointing out these guys generally don't make decisions based on someone's kind of like flippant intuition. They make decisions based on what they believe to be in the better interest. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but in the better interest of economic prosperity and longevity.
They got a 100-year plan, let's be honest.
And so there's data that certainly underlies this. Yeah. And I think we all know it intuitively. We can certainly read reports. But in the United States, we value individual liberties above all else. And so we don't find ourselves in the circumstance. It seems foreign and scary and crazy. But again, it's another, tool
we're
that
get
China
to something
will
else
use
later.
To outcompete this century.
Yes, that's true. But let's be clear. We don't value individual liberties. That's not true. That's just what we tell people, but that's not totally true. And you know that's that.
I'm not going to go there, but yes.
Well, I mean, we are literally sitting here fighting. There's a group of individuals who are fighting to wear masks or not have to wear masks, rather, not have to take the vaccine. And at the same time, and I don't know if we want to go there, we are denying a woman's
we have right to choose.
Let's go to David Sacks. David Sacks, are you in support of Texas's abortion ban?
No, let's just hear him on China.
No, I think it's a stupid law, and I'll explain why in a second. But just on the China thing for a second, this is like, I'll be a dissenting voice here. This is like if we had given Tipper Gore dictatorial powers. I mean, this is insane. They're gonna determine how many hours a kid can play video games. I mean, look, I get the potential benefit, but this is incredibly intrusive into the lives of citizens. And I'm not sure that video game playing is altogether a negative thing. You know, I think it's mostly our kids go through a phase where they play a lot of games and they grow out of it. And, you know, you talk to developers, like computer programmers, they all went through some phase where they were like hyper addicted to video games. It, you know, builds hand-eye coordination. It builds computer literacy. So I'm not sure it's like, look, obviously if someone does nothing but computer games their whole life, that's a problem. But as a phase that a kid goes through, it's not the end of the world.
I agree with you, because I used to play 3 hours of fucking Zelda a day when I came home, because I was a latchkey kid. No, because I was a latchkey kid and I didn't have anybody to take care of me. I don't think, David, though, that that's what kids are getting when they're playing 4 hours of fucking Call of Duty every night.
4 hours? And these kids are playing 10 hours a day.
Well, by the way, I think China has another motivation for this ban, which is they've got a lot of, because of the one-child policy, right? They've got a radical misbalance of, you know, male to female ratio. They've got a lot of young males without romantic prospects in that country. Basically, they have an incel problem.
It's
a giant incel problem. I don't think we hear much about it because they control the media, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of just That's random violence out there. And the last thing they want to do is have these incels playing Fortnite and Call of Duty, shooting people 5 hours a night and then getting their brains wired that way. That might be playing into this decision. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, validating the mental health aspect. They've studied the mental health implications of these video games.
And I think that's my point. I'm not arguing for the ban. I'm arguing for the fact that China has certainly done something to indicate, they have some data that indicates why they should make this decision. It may be, you're right, it may be about kind of, you know, growing, getting people to be more romantic and get out of the house and go get married and have kids and whatnot. But there's certainly and remember, their objective function is always about longevity and economic prosperity. So, you know, there's something that's making them say that we can increase economic prosperity, increase longevity by doing this. And that outweighs whatever the detrimental social and other effects might be. I think there's something to read into it. But no matter what, every big decision they make has some degree of competitive advantage for them. And, you know, those kids, if they're not playing video games, they're going to be doing something else. Like, I don't know, programming computers, doing biotechnology in a lab, figuring stuff out on the internet, writing the next cryptocurrency. I don't know, but there's going to be some advantage that's going to arise out of the time and the productivity that's going to be generated by this. And I think that's the calculus that they're undertaking here. I'm not saying it's right or wrong.
We all agree they're thoughtful. The question is, what is this going to do for this generation if they don't play video games? Are they going to be more productive? Are they going to be, you know,
they'll be good drones for the collective, you know?
You're right.
And that's the downside here is, even if they get it right in this particular case, how much freedom do you have to give up? How much state surveillance is there in the enforcement? And how many other insane policies will they foist on people with this mentality of, you don't get to live your life individually, you got to serve this collective?
This is actually, I think, your best point, Sax, is that I think what could happen here is you can overplay a hand. And by squeezing people too tightly, you can't play video games, you can't run your own companies, you're going to get replaced, you know, you can't practice your own religion, you can't say what you want, be a journalist. These things could add up, and they could, you know, piss off a young group of people who do what happened in Tiananmen Square or in Hong Kong, and they could be dealing with, their own revolution. And what if it's video games? Revolutions have started over similarly, seemingly simple acts by an authoritarian government, taking away people's right to sell fruit on the street, you know, famously started the Spring Awakening in the Middle East. So You could see this actually, I think, you know, maybe it's a small chance, 5% or 10%, you know, creating a lot of social unrest.
Do you want to? All right. Should we go to Texas? You guys want to talk about that?
Speaking of social unrest, I'm going to lose my mind here.
All right, here we go. SB 8 creates a private cause of action that enables Texans to sue those who perform or aid and abet the performance of abortions after a fetal heartbeat has been detected. The ban comes 2 years after abortion restrictions were proposed in Georgia, Mississippi, Kentucky, and Louisiana. The previous propositions were spoken out publicly against by progressive tech companies, companies with a female customer base, and women-led businesses. That proposed bill never became law. Sachs, you want to just frame for us the legal sort of case here?
Yeah.
And then let's go to...
Well, do you want to go back and actually frame Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey? I think those are important to understand what the hell's going on here.
Sure. Okay. Well, so, you know, Roe obviously gave women the right to choose, the reproductive freedom over, you know, invalidated abortion laws very, very, in a very, very sweeping way. Casey sort of modified Roe. It upheld it, but modified it, saying that the state could impose some restrictions as long as it didn't place an undue burden. That was a key term, undue burden on a woman's right to choose. And I think what was at issue in that case was, I think it was Pennsylvania. The state of Pennsylvania imposed a waiting period and some consultation with an advisor. And so it delayed the abortion, but it didn't restrict or didn't otherwise eliminate. So Casey, Roe as modified by Casey is really the law of the land right now, which is the undue burden. Then Texas comes along. And do you want me to explain this law?
Yeah.
So this law is, regardless of what you think about abortion, it's a really bizarre law, because what it does is it doesn't just ban abortion outright. What it does is create a private right of action, basically a right to sue in civil court anyone who aids and abets an abortion after about 5 or 6 weeks. So
6 weeks.
6 weeks. Basically, after a fetal heartbeat can be detected. So, which is about 6 weeks into the pregnancy. And the way the law works is that, so point one, abortion providers are prohibited from performing an abortion if they can detect fetal heart tones. Again, that's 6 weeks. There's no exception for rape and incest. I think that's really explosive politically.
Horrible? Do you think it's horrible as a human?
Yeah, I think
I'm curious your personal position.
Yeah, well, let's get that. Let me just explain the law. So the law puts the onus of enforcement on private citizens, not government officials. Okay, they do that to make it harder to legally challenge this under Roe and Casey. Okay, so what the government has done here, what Texas has done, is it gives private citizens the ability to sue abortion providers or anyone who aids and abets someone to get an abortion. So it could be an Uber driver. It could be a friend who simply drives someone to the abortion clinic. It could be a person who provides financial assistance. It could be a secretary who works at the abortion clinic. They can all be sued now under aiding and abetting. And here's really the person who had the abortion cannot be sued, but anyone who aided and abetted can be. That's how they're getting around the right to choose. And here's the craziest part is the citizens who choose to sue don't need to show any connection to the person they're suing. And they don't even have to live in the state, right? So there's no connection to them. There's no personal injury to them, but they're basically suing under a personal injury, under a civil right of action. And if they succeed, the law states that they're entitled to at least $10,000 in damages, yeah, in addition to their legal costs. So if they win, their legal costs get paid, but if they lose, they don't have to cover the defendant's legal fees. So they just get a free shot here. Which is also, I've never seen a loser pay rule like this. I mean, there are loser pay rules, but they're symmetric. So we have an asymmetric loser pays rule. But I don't think we've ever had a civil law like this where somebody can sue where there's no injury to them. There's no standing here. This is the thing that's fundamentally, I think, at odds with our entire legal tradition. And I think regardless of what you think about abortion, this law will eventually be invalidated by the Supreme Court or a lower court on that ground that they're allowing people to sue without standing. And it's a horrible precedent, because can you imagine if what Texas is basically doing is deputizing private citizens to enforce in civil courts a prohibition that they cannot or will not pass directly.
Is this the best they could come up in your?
Hold on. Let's just state a couple more facts. Like, this was an extremely well thought out law. I think that the pro-life faction in Texas clearly had some very smart constitutional thinkers that were able to navigate around Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey to get something written that could be passed in a way where, you know, Sam Alito just basically punted and said, we're not going to give a stay. And so this is going to have to meander through the courts. There is still a risk that it could just get kicked down to Texas and it could remain a state issue, which there is a big risk. And if that's true, then, you know, other states could basically take a run at copying this law. What I wanted to talk about was, if you bring it all together, you know, Friedberg said something about, like, you know, we really value personal freedom. And this is where I was like cynically, like, actually, that's not true. This is an example in my opinion of where this is just like, we are very hypocritical, where, you know, if we talk about a vaccine mandate, you know, there's just an entire fiery, you know, up in arms of people, usually typically in the same states, that are very anti-abortion, that are like, you know, tread on me lightly, you can't touch my body, you know, I have the right to decide. But when it comes to this topic, they abandon all of that and they go to the extreme opposite side, which is the government mandates. And to be able to say that to 50% of the population, that just because you are born with reproductive organs, that you're treated different, or specifically, you know, a uterus, ovaries, and a vagina, you're treated differently than a man, to me just seems absolutely insane and just like fundamentally just erodes this idea of equality, like at just a very principled level. And the even worse thing is that then, you know, the corporations that actually used to be on the front lines of helping to drive social justice so far have been completely absent, right? You have to remember in 2019, when we had these very repressive abortion laws, I think it was in Mississippi or Alabama, you had all of these companies come out and say, hey, no, not here, not under our watch. Then when you had all these voter suppression laws in Georgia, right? You had all these companies come out and say, hey, absolutely not, not on our watch. We will leave the state if you implement these things. But so far, what you've seen in this law is complete radio silence in Texas. And this is, you know, you have to remember, Texas is the 9th largest economy in the world, right? In the world. So you have every single kind of company, from technology to otherwise, who have chosen to either start or relocate their businesses in the state. And I got to think that, you know, these employees and these leaders of these businesses should be saying something, and they haven't said a damn thing.
Friedberg,
you have thoughts? And then we'll go to you, Sex.
Look, I feel like everyone has a limit to what they believe defines individual liberty. You know, should everyone have complete freedom to the point that they can take a gun and go shoot anyone that they want? The answer is no. I think even the most diehard libertarians would argue that there's some degree of, what is it, John Stuart Mill's sex. You know, you should have the ability to do whatever you want within your sphere of influence, as long as it doesn't intersect with the sphere of influence of others. And so the philosophical argument that I believe the pro-life movement made, which is really a different point of view on values, is that the sphere of influence of a fetus exists at some point in time, and therefore shouldn't be invaded by the mother. Now, I'm not speaking, obviously, my point of view. My point of view is extremely pro-choice, just to be very clear. But the argument is I think one that we all kind of blush over and assume that it's about taking away a woman's right without recognizing the voice on the other side, which says that there is a right to life by a fetus at a certain point in time. And so to me, there's almost like this principle debate that arises, and it probably certainly falls more along religious lines than it does along on a religious spectrum than it does on a kind of a libertarian spectrum or a spectrum of liberties that kind of defines that crossover point for people. But clearly, Texas is a really interestingly confused state, right? I mean, there's this argument about individual freedom, but now what comes across is a highly kind of conservative point of view with respect to the freedom of a pregnant woman. And so, you know, I don't know if there really is an easy answer. It certainly seems to me nowadays that the pro-choice movement is the majority, the pro-life movement is the minority. And maybe I'm off on that, Zach, you probably know better. But, you know, I'm not sure this truly does set a precedent that becomes kind of a widespread recognition of a new way of addressing kind of the pro-life movement or giving the pro-life movement some additional movement. I still think that the pro-life movement remains a minority, and over time that will, you know, there'll be perturbations, but there'll certainly be some resolution over time in favor of what I think
the
majority.
Where are all the politically correct people? Where are they? Where are they right now? Where are all the politically, I mean, like, I guess they were happy to get Mike Richards or whatever the guy's name was fired from Jeopardy last week, but where are they now when we really need them?
But Chamath, are you really saying there's not enough outrage about this? I mean, I'm seeing a ton of outrage on social media about this.
Yeah, I see everything. I see nothing.
I see a lot of useless virtue signaling. I don't see anything that's actually
organized. Well, I think what we're talking about here is the leadership of companies and leaders in big companies. Where are they?
My prediction is going to be a million-person march within 45 days.
Okay, well, let me go back to Chamath's point about whether, you know, he called this bill smart in the sense that it was really thought through. I agree that it's a deliberate attempt to circumvent Roe v. Wade and make it harder to sustain a legal challenge against it. But I don't think this is smart. I think it's stupid philosophically, politically, and legally for the pro-life movement. So philosophically, I think the problem here is they're creating unlimited standing to sue across state boundaries by somebody who hasn't even experienced harm. I mean, this is so far from what conservative jurists and legal scholars have always professed to believe. I mean, I remember 20 years ago, tort reform and ending frivolous lawsuits was the absolute bedrock plank on the, you know, of the Republican Party. So they're just throwing that out the window here with unknown consequences. Hold on a second. For example, why wouldn't this be used to circumvent people's Second Amendment rights? Why wouldn't you just create a private right of action to sue anyone who, quote, you know, aided and abetted a gun crime? You know, so I think this is going to boomerang on conservatives. Second,
here's what let me get
to the political stupidity of it, and then
Henry
legal
Belcaster wanted this as one piece, so he didn't have to do so much editing. Chamath,
no, look,
sex finish.
No, look. The Wall Street Journal has a great editorial today. Okay, this is the Wall Street Journal editorial page is a great piece. This is from they basically say, look, they said sometimes we wonder if Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is a progressive plant. That's the guy behind this. His ill-conceived legal attack against Obamacare backfired Republicans in last year's election and lost at the Supreme Court. Now he is leading with his chin on abortion. How about thinking first? So they're pretty clear this is going to get overturned. And frankly, then politically, this is just handed. This is, you know, Democrats are already having a field day with this. So Biden said, this law is so extreme, it does not even allow for exceptions in the case of rape and incest. I mean, look, he's right about that. And Gavin Newsom, the polling for him is now going through the roof because all he has to do for the next 10 days is talk about right to choose in this Texas bill. And he's going to cruise towards defeating the recall, because it's basically
you're talking about something differently than I was. What I'm saying is something very specific. If you go back to Roe v. Wade, it was written by a man, first of all, which, you know, we can debate whether that makes any fucking sense. But Harry Blackmun went to the Mayo Clinic and lived there for like 6 or 8 weeks reading medical textbooks and came up with this trimester framework. And again, I'm just going to go out on a limb and say, I don't have a fucking clue what's going on in a woman's body. And I don't think Harry Blackmun did, even though he was much smarter than I and was on the Supreme Court. Okay. And then Casey tried to clean this up by going to this fetal viability thing. So we have this law that was really kind of ill-conceived, but was kind of going in the right direction, but it was really a very first form of judicial activism. We tried to clean it up in the early 90s, but it's always been an issue. Where eventually what's really been happening is we've been pushing this to a state's right issue. And I think that the cleverness of this bill, and it's dangerous, but it was very well thought out. This was not a random thing where two haphazard dipshits got together and wrote this bill, David. I think that this was methodically planned out for years. And
they
are
dipshits, though. It's totally going to backfire on them. It's not going to...
For example... We now have an activist Supreme Court who may actually not opine on this, on the validity of the issue, but say this is a state's right issue. If this stays in Texas and doesn't get outside of Texas, you will have this specific thing hold and stand. And I think that that's a very bad precedent to have set. I think that these folks planned this out, and I don't think they thought that it was an easy way to overturn it. And I think that's why when everybody was waiting with bated breath, for Alito to basically stay this, he didn't.
Listen, I think there's a lot of hysteria and hyperbole on social media right now saying that Roe v. Wade's been overturned. The Supreme Court has overturned
Roe
v. Wade.
I'm not saying that. Yeah,
I
get it. Those are morons who don't know anything.
Yes, but they're saying that because the Supreme Court ruled on very narrow procedural grounds that it wasn't ready to hear about the Texas law because a harm hasn't been committed yet. But they haven't said they won't look at it in the future. I believe they will. I believe that this law will be found unconstitutional. Not necessarily.
Do you think these companies?
Not necessarily because of abortion, but just because
they're changing the legal
definition of standing in a way that flies against everything we know about how the court system works. I think ultimately this is too clever by half by the state attorney general. I think it was.
I think he's a tool.
All right. Do we want to move on and talk about Apple allowing people to link to their own websites? And
the Apple thing is really big news because it kind of goes to show you that you had a pretty progressive legislative framework in South Korea. I don't think it's particularly a huge market for Apple because most of the app activity, I think, is Android more than it is Apple. But they basically just seeded the market, and by deciding to basically conform to this law, then they started with these reader apps and allowing payments, allowing you to link outside. It's the beginning of the beginning for, you know, the app stores to be deconstructed and opened.
This, just so people understand, Apple said it would allow media apps to create in-app links to sign-up pages on those companies' websites, allowing the likes of Spotify and Netflix to bypass the iPhone maker's cut of subscriptions. Now, of course, you can use Spotify and Netflix on your phone, but you may have probably people haven't experienced this because they've already become members of it and did it on their site, but you can't actually pay through your phone and you can't sign up through the app. They were technically not allowed to link to it. So this is a small concession only to media folks. So what do you think, Sax?
Well, I think Chamath has kind of said this at the beginning of the end. I think there's some truth to that. Look, I think the root of this is the fact that Apple has this 30% rate on any in-app purchases. And like Bill Gurley said, it's a rake too far, right? Just because you can charge 30% doesn't mean you should charge 30%. Ultimately, this is why the whole ecosystem has been up in arms. They formed an industry coalition to challenge Apple. That resulted in a lot of legal challenges, lawsuits, and you know, a lot of these companies like Spotify and Tile, they testified against Apple in hearings. So I think this 30% rake has ultimately backfired on Apple. It's created a huge backlash, and now they're paying the price. They've already had to roll it back for these so-called reader apps. So, you know, if what you're doing is buying a subscription to, say, Netflix, Netflix will now be able to redirect you to their website. You can buy it there and then consume the content, you know, on your iOS app without Apple getting a part of the split. But this now opens the door for this type of thing to apply to games as well, where there's a lot more in-app purchases, like Fortnite, right? So I just think this is a case where, you know, what's the old line that pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered? Apple has been a hog, and now it's getting slaughtered.
Yeah.
By the way, I want to point out, like, this is a really interesting experience of the free market. You know, clearly consumers and the developers on the apps in the App Store ecosystem were vocal and angry enough that this behavioral change from Apple, the structural change, kind of came to bear. It didn't require regulatory intervention. I just want to point out how important and relevant that is. That having
the market is functional.
The market is functional, and having the government and regulators come in, and you know, people complaining to the Senate about Google and Apple monopolizing them out of their businesses, ultimately gets resolved when there's enough kind of collective mass from the consumer slash partner that says to the big incumbent player, we're not going to play by these games anymore, by these rules anymore.
I gotta think Lina Khan being appointed did make Apple think maybe
it may have instigated,
should stop.
Right? It may have instigated enough fear here, right? To kind of start giving concessions, right?
Yeah. Some modest concession that, yeah, if you're a Spotify or a Netflix or Audible, we're going to let you buy through the app.
I mean, Jack, you're all about government regulation and all these antitrust.
Well, yeah.
Don't you think this is a nice win for the free market?
Yeah, I do. Well, look, I don't think monopolies are, I don't think letting monopolies do whatever they want is free market, okay? I mean, monopolies end competition. They will squash innovation. They will, you know, they will basically get in the way of permissionless innovation. So I, you know, I'm in favor of reining in these monopolies. And the two big issues, I think, with Apple and Google, well, Apple especially, is number one, sideloading of apps. So the idea that they have total control over what apps get loaded onto your iOS device. People want the ability to create alternative app stores. That already exists for Android, right? So I think that is coming for Apple. Apple claims it's a security issue, but...
It is. I mean, what they should do is if you click on sideload apps, it should just give you a warning. You are no longer protected by us. You know, you're subjecting yourself to phishing scams, your information, and buyer beware. And then people can make their own decision. I've always thought that would be the best decision for it. What I like about this is I think this gives Apple the ability to now just compete against everybody in the App Store without having to have this, you know, well, we're partners with you. They are not partners with people in the App Store. They watch the App Store. And when something great comes and emerges, they will copy it. They just do it slower than Facebook. So Apple Music studied Spotify and they created their own Apple product. Apple TV Plus now with Ted Lasso is competing against Netflix. They watch Netflix. And I signed up for Apple Arcade for my daughters because I didn't want them to be paying for in-app purchases. I'd rather just have the games be stop upselling them. And that's been wonderful for $5 or $10 a month to have that. And I pay for the news product. So now they can just compete against everybody directly. I think all of these media companies are going to be video games, podcasts, TV shows, and music. So I don't know if you saw Netflix is going to be doing podcasts about their shows and video games. I think Amazon will be video games content. It's all going to be one thing. And Disney Plus will have games built into Disney Plus, I bet, in that subscription price. So the consumer is going to win ultimately.
You know, I think monopolies are good because monopolies are just like lazy, and it's easier to innovate and compete against a monopoly, to be honest, than it is to compete against cronyism. When there's kind of embedded kind of government regulation that prevents emerging competitors from competing effectively, it's a lot harder to win than against some slow, big, uninnovative monopoly. Go ahead.
Well, here's the counter argument. So I agree with you that big, slow, lumbering monopolies can be great to compete against. But here's the problem. When they control access to an ecosystem, when they're gatekeepers, that's the problem. Because now you have to go to them and they're going to be slow, lumbering, and stupid in terms of allowing you to innovate. And when they see you becoming a threat, they'll squawk you. That's the problem. If these guys didn't control platforms, that would be one thing. But they control the most important platform there is, which is the operating system. So I just think that, you know, this is Microsoft and Windows all over again, except there's two of them, right? There's iOS and Android.
Well, and in Microsoft's example, you could load whatever software you wanted. They were just bundling. They weren't saying you couldn't load Netscape. They're just saying, we're going to give you Internet Explorer with the operating system. So this is even worse. I mean, Apple is saying you can't even install your app.
Yeah, Microsoft was actually pretty open by comparison, but there is like a version of bundling here. What Spotify said is, look, when we have to pay 30% and Apple Music doesn't have to pay anything, we can't compete with that, you know? And they have a point there.
Yeah, it's a completely valid point. California's on fire. This is what, the third or fourth year in a row this has gotten acute for the Bay Area. People are now making plans, as Freeberg mentioned on the last pod, I think, there's like two or three weeks of the year, maybe even a month, where you just can't really be outside and
do stuff.
Northern California. You can't be outside.
Three of our friends have been evacuated because, you know, they moved up there in the middle of the pandemic. They had to come down. They said it was raining ash. You know, one of our friends' homes is literally threatened. It's just like, and then the fire season is moving up earlier and earlier in the year. You know, my kids were in camp in Tahoe this July and they had to be evacuated. And fortunately for us, you know, we had a really good friend of ours, a neighbor here whose kids were also at that camp, be able to drive up in the, but my God, like that was,
you know, there's about, there's about $8 trillion of real estate value, in California. And, you know, if you assume a tenth of that is exposed in the middle of this kind of dense fire, these dense fire regions. Let's say it's $1 trillion. But $1 trillion of real estate value that you cannot insure anymore. So
I had an idea about this, Freeberg. I was looking 2 or 3 years ago when these fires started, maybe it was 4 or 5 years ago now, for a blanket that could go over a home, could be installed or dropped over a home with helicopters. I know this sounds crazy, but is there a material that's light enough that you could put it on a helicopter and drop it over one of these?
Yeah, asbestos 2-3 million. Would work.
Yeah. Well, why doesn't this startup exist? I mean, this would be amazing. Imagine if these homes had on the roof some sort of a system that when fire or heat got there, it just deployed the blanket and protected the home.
I don't know if you guys know this, but right now in Marin County in California, it's nearly impossible to get fire insurance. And this is becoming kind of a predominant factor in California, particularly in all the areas with lots of forest land. There's 100 million acres of forest land in California. So if $1 trillion of real estate is actually exposed to fires and you can't get fire insurance, ask yourselves the question, what's going to happen when hundreds of billions of dollars of real estate literally goes up in smoke or gets sold off? Who ultimately bears the cost? Where does that cost have its economic flow? And that's just the tip of the iceberg of the effects that may arise as these things start to take hold. You know, we had this huge upswing in real estate in Tahoe as everyone moved out of California and went to Tahoe during the pandemic. Now we're seeing Tahoe real estate sell off like crazy. This happened in wine country in Sonoma and Napa County last year after the big fires they had there. And so there are counties where you start to have these massive fires causing this massive real estate sell-off, and or the real estate burns and it's uninsured. And guess what happens? FEMA steps in, right? The federal government steps in. And ultimately, the federal government's going to have these like Katrina events 4 or 5 times a year that we're going to be underwriting losses for people's real estate that's valued in a way that doesn't account for the effects of climate change.
You know,
this
I started
a massive shift in economic value that someone's going to have to pay for over so the next decade. And this is just the beginning of it all, is my strong belief.
I tweeted this out about maybe 6 or 7 months ago, but with this fabulous entrepreneur named David Soloff, I co-founded an insurance company called OTT Risk. And, you know, we've been trying to build models and price this kind of insurance, climate insurance, you know, social media kinds of like disruptions, civil unrest insurance, things that are very atypical. And to your point, Freeberg, it is really, really hard to try to forecast what's going on in a way where you can actually insure these things with a margin of safety. And so just as a person who would be the provider of this kind of insurance, what I'm learning is, man, we're negotiating multi-hundred-million-dollar policies with these big corporates. And, you know, for example, like, you know, they want pandemic insurance. If there's the next Delta variant or whatever, and I have to shut down my facility and here's my economic loss, I want to, you know, you to insure that. And okay, it's impossible. And so I can only imagine what it's like then on the ground floor, somebody to just buy some insurance that says, if my house burns down,
yeah,
it's very hard.
Get it. So
and this kind of parametric insurance doesn't exist, which means that if you live in any of these areas, I think what it means is that climate change is going to ravage suburbs, and it's going to ravage these sort of like far-flung communities, because nobody's going to want to step in there and insure the parametric risk that allows people to live there safely.
You know what I just realized?
This was my last company, right? Climate Corp, we started out in 2006, we offered parametric weather insurance online. And so it was all about our mission was to manage and adapt to climate change. And so you could buy weather insurance online and you underwrite the risk. And the way you underwrite risk like this and auto insurance and any kind of insurance is you look at past data, you build a statistical model that's represented by the past data and the frequency of certain things happening. And that's how you price the insurance. The problem now is the past data has absolutely no bearing on what's going on. Yeah. And so you have to basically create more fundamental deterministic models of fires, which is something no one's really good at. No one has any ability to do because we've never seen this kind of environment before. We've never seen hot year after hot year, dry year after dry year. And so there's no historical data to draw from to build the model. So all the insurers throw their hands in the air and they say, we can't take on that risk. We don't know how to price it. And when they don't do that, I'm telling you, the government's going to end up having to step in and pay people money for the lost homes.
Or the government's going to have to say, the reality here is that we can't afford to do this and you can't build homes there. And talk about functioning markets. I think what we're realizing is the market now is so convinced that global warming is real and you can't deny it, that we just can't insure for it. Therefore, we're going to have to make serious societal changes. And that's part of this process. Insurance being denied for hurricane zones and insurance being denied for fire zones is part of the process of people accepting the reality that we're not doing enough.
Yeah, J-Cal, the problem is not that it's going to be denied. It's that you're not going to be able to get it. And if you are, you're not going to be able to afford it. And so it's not even that people are really open to writing the kind of cover that allows you to go and safely live in Lake Tahoe 10 or 15 years from now. And that's the shame of it. So we have these beautiful places that I think are just going to be under duress and under pressure. And it's going to force everybody to live more and more in the major metropolitan areas, which is, you know, I'm not sure that that's what everybody wants.
Or it's going to change building. I mean, we saw now in Florida and other places, you know, Louisiana, other places that are flood zones, nobody builds on the ground floor anymore. Everybody builds, you know, on stilts, and they put a car garage underneath it because it's going to flood it. I have friends in New York this week, and I'm here, and I had to change my flight to come to New York for the wedding that I'm going to. I had to change my flight because last night we were going to be flying into this craziness here. They got 3 inches of rain in 1 hour. 15 people, my understanding, has died in basement apartments because they couldn't or they didn't get out in time. It's kind of hard to understand, but I guess people stayed in their apartments while they were filling up with water, and then
See the video of like the floodwaters ripping into the New York subway?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, I mean, God.
And New York is not built for this. So now New York's going to just basically have to say, you know what? All the basement apartments, all the basements that exist, they're not livable. You can't live in a basement anymore. And when we build new structures, the first floor is going to be built like they build them in Miami, which is for water to flow straight through them. Right. And the garages underneath are designed to accept massive floodwaters.
I've been spending a lot of time on water recently. And the thing that I learned this week, which not the thing that I learned, but a great way to summarize this for folks listening if they don't understand climate change is the areas that are hotter get hotter, the areas that are drier get drier, and the areas that get wetter get much more wet. And so when you have a period of dryness or heat, it's going to be extreme. And when it rains, it's going to be so extreme. And we're just going to get buffeted back and forth between these two extremes. And this is only going to escalate over the next 20 years or 30 years because we have so much embedded pollution that we have to work our way through. Forget all the new stuff, but all this embedded pollution has a cost. And we're just starting to begin processing that pollution.
Well, welcome to the All In Depressed episode.
I mean, fucking depressive. Wait, this is my goddamn birthday, guys. What the fuck?
Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Women's rights are being taken away.
Ridiculous.
The planet is on fire. New York is underwater. COVID is not ending. Nobody can insure anything. And
I don't know, man. The market's ripping. There's lots of money coming into climate change. Investors and entrepreneurs are more optimistic than they've ever been. You know, there's a backdrop of challenge, but with challenge comes opportunity. And I think people are pursuing it like nuts right now. And it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. No, I like the way you say entrepreneurs, because I say it entrepreneurs, but you say it entrepreneurs.
Yeah, it's got an E and a U, Tamath. I mean,
entrepreneur.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a very literal pronunciation of it.
I think you're
a real Schwengali of the word entrepreneur.
Schwengali. Are you going to monetize something now, Sax?
Yeah, go ahead, Sax. Monetize your new app.
Monetize Colin.
Yeah, leverage the All-In audience.
Yeah, that's the good news here. Colin's doing really well. Great long.
I'm going to be rich. Tahoe's on fire. The jewel of California.
You're going to be ash,
but Colin got 10,000 downloads. Yeah.
I think that in terms of processing all the bad news, I do think we have a tendency to underestimate how much political partisans sort of whip things up. In any event, should we end with this Rogan thing? I actually think it's a pretty good issue to talk about.
Joe Rogan got COVID. I think they misframed what he said. I actually saw the original quote where he said, should a young person take the vaccine? This was in the very early days of the vaccine, or should they wait a little bit and see if it's safe? I think was his position, not one I agree with, but I don't think what he said was absolutely crazy. His quote was, if someone has an ideological, physiological reason for not getting vaccinated, I don't want to force them to get vaccinated. So, and then he got it and he had to cancel some shows.
I think there's something kind of funny here, but also kind of serious here about the way the media covers news like this. First of all, the media is positively gleeful whenever they can report that somebody who expressed any vaccine hesitancy or skepticism gets COVID, right? It's almost ghoulish, I think. Look, I'm vaccinated. I'm really happy I got the vaccine. I think it helped me have a much, much milder case of COVID than I either would have had. So I'm pro-vax or whatever, but here's what the media does. And the craziest headline I saw about Rogan was that Rogan is taking a horse dewormer as medicine.
That was so dumb.
Referring to ivermectin, right? Now, look, I don't know whether ivermectin is a helpful treatment or not. I think you got to do a double-blind study to figure that out. But I also think that it's very dishonest to be describing ivermectin as a horse dewormer. I mean, the person who invented ivermectin intended it as a treatment for humans. Humans do take it as a treatment against certain parasites. It also happens to have a benefit in deworming horses, but that's just one of its applications. So to describe this drug as a horse dewormer as if it was the only thing it does, the purpose of that is to make anyone who thinks that ivermectin is a possible treatment, to make them look ridiculous, right? And, you know, so why is the press doing that? Well, the agenda is the press decided that vaccines are good. Okay, I agree with them about that. But this is where it goes off the rails. They decide that anybody, in pursuing that agenda, they have to make any alternative vaccine, which would be any therapeutic treatment, and anyone who would take that therapeutic treatment look ridiculous. And this is where I think the media just cross over into total dishonesty. They're doing the same thing with monoclonal antibodies, which actually I think are a treatment that works. But anyone who is expressing support for
this all goes back to the polarization with Trump, right? What was the drug that he was such a big proponent of that didn't actually work?
Hydroxychloroquine.
So I think it's back to that. What do you think, Friedberg? Are you have any opinion on Joe Rogan getting dunked on?
It's interesting to observe how much we've kind of, as with a lot of things, when I say we, I mean like society, each of us, reading social media, the internet, media itself, kind of orient things along a spectrum, right and wrong, black and white, left and right. I feel like vaccination and vaccines have similarly become you're either vaccinated and you're good, or you're not vaccinated or you're bad, or the opposite is true. And it's pretty clear, there's tons of evidence that vaccination, while it may reduce kind of the severity of COVID, you know, there seems to be much less protective effect with respect to transmission, particularly with this Delta variant now. And that's just a fact. You know, you can say, oh my gosh, I'm vaccinated, therefore I'm safe. It's like, no, you're also exposed to Delta as someone who's unvaccinated in terms of catching it and transmitting it to other people. There may be less severity and there may be less transmission. One interesting fact, by the way, is that there's much, much, much less time when you're vaccinated and you get infected with Delta when you're actually infectious. Yeah, incredibly reduced amount of time from like 10 days to like 1 to 2 days. But still, that is a very infectious kind of variant. And so it's spreading. But it's almost like we're blaming people that aren't vaccinated for Delta spreading. Delta's spreading because it's a really effective virus at spreading. It's like end of story. And this orientation around like you're the reason that Delta's spreading is completely false. And everyone tries to then fit the story into that narrative. You know, the Joe Rogan story.
Yeah, right. Don't you think there's like such a strong agenda?
The guy got infected. It sucks. Like it has nothing to do with
anything. Was he vaccinated or not?
He was vaccinated. I don't know. Who cares? Like the point is, it's not about he didn't do anything wrong in the sense, and he's not to blame. This Delta variant is infecting people. Sachs got infected with Delta. He's vaccinated.
No, I mean, I think the point people are trying to make here, Friedberg, is that he's been kind of, people believe that with his platform, he should be more pro-vax because vaccines, there's no downside.
But J-Cal, look, don't you agree there's such a media agenda here? Like once they decide what the agenda is going to be, in this case, it's pro-vax. And I'm not saying that's wrong, okay?
Right.
I'm just saying that the way the media works is first they decide what the agenda is going to be, then they distort everything to fit what their agenda is. So for example, ivermectin's called a horse dewormer. And the logic here is completely tortured. They just don't want there to be any therapeutic alternative to vaccination.
They don't want to give credit. Yeah.
They don't want to give credit to potentially, and the same thing's true. Now, look, I'm not saying ivermectin is an effective treatment. I have no idea, but there's no need to distort and demonize it before we even know what the truth is.
By the way, I wouldn't use the term agenda. I know that that's a commonly used term, that the media has an agenda. I would argue that the media has a narrative. And I would secondly argue that that narrative isn't necessarily defined by the media or by some set of people in control. but that that narrative is in effect defined by the consumers that consume the media.
And they whatever vote, they click on
they,
more.
Yeah. They vote with their views. And so the more views, the more clicks, the more dollars you spend on certain media outlets and certain writers, the more those writers get more stories to write and the more the consumption happens. And so my point of view is that the consumer ends up ultimately being the writer of the narrative and the definer of the narrative. And the storyline starts to fit that narrative versus feeling like we maybe felt years ago that, oh my gosh, there's a few people, this cabal that's in control of the media and they're running everything and they're telling us what to believe and see. I think consumers vote with their dollars. They vote with their views. And as a result, that is the narrative that gets written.
Yeah, they were not supposed to be tribal. They were supposed to be objective. That was the concept of reporting, is to just report the facts and let the
not when it became a consumer product.
Well, now it's always been a consumer product, but now it's just become so hard to run those businesses.
It's for profit, right? The more you sell, the more money you make. And if it's
got, you know what? It was supposed to be subscriptions were supposed to inoculate the writers from this that, oh, we're getting paid for subscribers, therefore we don't have to worry about clicks anymore. Now what's happened, it's worse because you will lose your paid subscribers if you don't give them what they want.
Yeah, I'm going to predict right now our downvotes on YouTube are going to be in the 6 to 10% range on this episode. We have covered freaking
you're not paying.
COVID,
abortion, Joe Rogan, vaccines.
The media, like, this is going to be our worst rated episode of all time.
But it was a good discussion between the four of us. All right, everybody. The Rain Man, David Sacks, please download the All In app. Just put a C in front of All In, and you'll find it in the App Store. Congratulations to the folks who got into the syndicate, and thank you to Sachs for allowing All In Syndicate to participate and lead the Series B. We're going to be leading the Series B. Sachs gave us the ability to lead the Series B.
I'm 45, bitches. I turned 45. I 45 never felt
45.
So good.
You look good. You need a little tuck of silver.
By the way, we have a show called All In After Party on Call In, where we've done a couple episodes, including we introduced our WAC pack. So sort of in between. So like actually what we should do is all the fans of the show, if you like All In and you want a little more bestie,
Just go to the after show.
Go and sign up for All In After Party. We have 4,400 subscribers already after one day on the app. It's pretty good.
Right. Yeah.
That's good.
I mean, it'd be great for those, especially if the WAC pack gets in there. I talked to our guy who does the merch, the bestie merch guy, and he said he's made like $5,000 or $6,000 on merch in the last quarter. Paying his way through school on it.
That's so great.
Yeah, I'm happy for him. All right, Freeberg, we'll see you at the production board closed event. Nobody can get in. Sorry, if you want a ticket, it's not available. Chamath, happy birthday.
Happy birthday, C.
Thanks, guys.
All right, we'll see you all.
David, wait, Sax, this is where you say happy birthday, you fucking
Yeah, happy birthday.
Jewel.
Say I love you, bestie.
HBD. Back at you.
HBD. /HBD. HBD.
Love you. Bye.
Has Sax ever used an emoji? I don't think Sax has ever used an emoji.
I mean, I have 10 years of text messages with this fuck. He's never used a single emoji once.
No, that's because he has no emotion. We'll put the emoji in there in the David subroutines.
He's written at one point, smiley emoticon. He wrote those words, smiley emoticon.
All right, and congratulations to producer Nick, who is getting married.
Yeah, tonight. Great fucking decision. Great. See you on the other side, you fucking dumbass.
Congratulations, Nick. We love you.
And Rachel.
And Rachel. Congratulations, guys.
Rachel, you're going to get half of the call-in stock that Nick has. So
yeah, congratulations. You got half of his advisor shares to call in. All right, we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
We'll let your winners ride.
Rain Man David Sacks.
Source it to the fans, and they've just gone crazy with it.
Love you, West. I'm the queen of quinoa.
I'm going all in.
What your winners lie.
Besties are back.
Go 13. That's my dog taking a notice in your driveway. Sex.
Where did it
go? Oh, man. My
haberdasher
will meet me
at We should all just get a room and just have one big, huge orgy, because they're all just useless. It's like this like sexual tension that they just need to release somehow.
Your feet.
That's gonna be good. We need to get merch.
I'm going all in.